On September 24th, 2023, in a remote part of the Utah desert, 80 miles north of Salt Lake City, the temperature was in the mid-50s. The sky was mostly clear, and there was a very slight breeze out of the southeast. All things considered, it was a perfectly ordinary day for an extraordinary event. 63,000 miles above the Earth's surface, about one-third the distance from the Earth to the Moon, a spacecraft released a capsule. It traveled 4 hours before streaking into the Earth's atmosphere at a blistering 27,000 miles per hour. 13 heart-pounding minutes later, it came to a safe landing on the Utah desert soil. It was the final destination of a 7-year journey from Earth to an asteroid and back. Yes, I said asteroid. If you're thinking this is a cheesy science fiction story written by an overzealous podcast writer, who would blame you? But it's not. It's a true story, and it's amazing.
Touchdown of the OSIRIS-REx sample return capsule, a journey of a billion miles to asteroid Bennu and back, has come to an end, marking America's first sample return mission of its kind and opening a time capsule to our ancient solar system.
If you haven't heard about NASA's OSIRIS-REx mission, well, you're in good company. Neither did some of the most well-informed people we know, our DIA teammates.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I admit, this is news to me.
I have not heard anything about that.
Sounds kind of crazy. Did you just make that up?
One of the great achievements in NASA history, and potentially the history of mankind, and yet not a lot of people heard about it.
I'm embarrassed that I don't know something that sounds really cool and impactful to our nation.
Interesting.
I don't think this is true. I think that's also why I haven't heard anything about it.
Oh, but it's true.
I didn't hear anything in the news or anywhere else.
When clues to questions like who are we and how did we get here could be answered, why wasn't it the lead story on the news? It turns out there was another big announcement the day the capsule touched down that got most of the attention.
It's the performance everyone is anxiously awaiting. Apple Music's Super Bowl 58 halftime show, headlined by Usher.
That's right. On September 24th, the NFL announced that Usher would be headlining the Super Bowl halftime show. Now, don't get me wrong. Usher's great, and he crushed it at the Super Bowl. But that the announcement took precedence over the asteroid, that's crazy. And you know what else is crazy? That I made that my first question to the NASA scientist who led the mission.
I'm Dante Loretta, a Regents Professor of Planetary Science and Cosmochemistry at the University of Arizona. And for the past 12 years, I've had the privilege of leading NASA's OSIRIS-REx asteroid sample return mission.
Dante, if you had another shot at it, and knowing that Usher's announcement would coincide with the landing, would you consider moving it either a day before or a day after?
I would not have changed a thing, because the day is not set by me. The day is set by the orbital mechanics of Bennu and the Earth.
But he grabbed the lead story. You know that, right?
I don't know that, no. Not in my world, he didn't.
It's a great story that was thankfully not news to one of our coworkers.
So I actually heard about it. I thought it was pretty amazing. All the calculation stuff to get something like that onto an object that's traveling as fast as it was. Yeah, pretty amazing.
At the Defense Intelligence Agency, we have a space mission too, but ours is closer to home.
Ours is the information role, the intelligence role.
That's John Huth, chief of DIA's Space and Counterspace Office. This episode features the intertwining missions of two experts who gather intelligence from space. Dante Loretta explores it.
So I always wanted to push the boundaries.
And John Huth helps protect it.
At the end of the day, it's really to make sure that we maintain the American way of life.
This is DIA Connections.
Space plays a critical role in our nation's security, in our prosperity, in our way of life. But our competitors understand this. They are fielding and developing increasingly complex capabilities aimed at degrading and denying U.S. space-based services.
NASA today showed off some of the space dust that was scraped off a 4.5 billion-year-old asteroid. NASA says initial studies show evidence of water and carbon. Those are the building blocks of life on Earth.
Pristine pieces of a rare, dark, carbon-rich asteroid. The idea that I could pick one of them and have a sample delivered back to Earth seemed like magic, like we were wizards summoning stones from outer space into our laboratories.
One of the iconic things about the Jetsons is a lot of that stuff that they were talking about, like, you know, the large TVs on the wall, household robots, etc., you know, broadly speaking, they are here.
Thanks for joining us on DIA Connections. We're calling this one Lasers, Asteroids, and the Jetsons. The most dangerous rock in our solar system is Asteroid Bennu. That's the first sentence of our guest Dante Loretta's book called The Asteroid Hunter. And the words most dangerous rock are in all caps. Dante led the mission to one of the most potentially hazardous near-Earth asteroids. And you can't say that without thinking of the 1998 thriller Armageddon.
Is this going to hit us?
What kind of damage?
Damage? Total, sir. It's what we call a global killer. The end of mankind. Doesn't matter where it hits, nothing would survive, not even bacteria.
God, what do we do?
That's a good question. Dante, what do we do? You called Bennu the most dangerous rock in our solar system. Wasn't that one of the reasons for going to the asteroid? To get more information about a potential doomsday?
Yeah, we collected all the information that any team would need to know if future humanity needs to come up with an impact deflection mission. Bennu has the highest probability of impacting the Earth of any object that we know about. And I don't want people to panic because the impact would be in the year 2182. So we have some time to deal with it if we need to, if we do have to stop an asteroid on a collision course.
All right, so we have enough time to make a plan. That's good to know. In a few minutes, we'll have more with Dante about the mission to survey the asteroid Bennu and the return to Earth of a sample for scientific analysis. And Dante shared some stories of his personal journey of discovery. But first, let's talk about DIA's space mission. That's the one that takes place in Earth's lower orbit. Here's John Huth, chief of DIA's Space and Counterspace Office. He spoke with historian Paul Isaacson about the agency's role in space.
John, you now lead the Office of Space and Counterspace. Tell us about that office and what it does. Why does it exist?
It's a component, clearly, of the larger agency whose job it is to provide space and counterspace intelligence to our customers and provide that to our warfighters or operational customers, our policymakers, and to our acquisition community.
John, now we're in a different kind of a space race than we had before, right? Tell us what's going on now with the new space race.
The space race now, I'd say, is multifaceted. Multifaceted from the point of view that it's not just two players now, it's at least three when you think about sovereign nations, but it's actually more than that. Space has become what we call competitive, congested, and contested. And that really talks about the evolving counter space capabilities, particularly by Russia and China.
I like those three words, competitive, congested, and contested.
Yeah, we as a nation recognize that, or certainly as a department recognized that about a decade or so ago.
One of the many recipients of DIA intel is the Space Force. Here's General Chance Saltzman, Space Force Chief of Operations.
We must be prepared to undertake responsible counterspace campaigning. We must preserve our advantages without incentivizing rivals to escalate to destructive military activities in space. Because if we do not have space, we lose.
So in contrast to the space race of 60 years ago that was between the Soviet Union and us, who are our biggest threats today?
Certainly Russia, the successor, if you will, of the Soviet Union, but China is probably the biggest. And then to a lesser degree, North Korea and Iran.
Our primary strategic competitors are taking steps to undercut the United States and our allies in the space domain.
On the DIA website, there's a video called Challenges to Security in Space. You should check it out when you have a chance. It's a great visual of the adversarial threats that John refers to.
Since early 2019, the competitor space operation...
The Department of Defense has stated that space has emerged as our most essential warfighting domain. Can you tell us why that's the case?
Absolutely, and it's a pretty easy answer. Every other domain of warfare depends on what is provided either through space or from space. Communications, intelligence support, weather, precision, timing, navigation, all those services come through space or from space.
What is the danger in us not being competitive? What's at stake?
What's at stake is potentially our adversaries taking our ability away to project power or to live the way we normally live day in and day out. So what do I mean by that? You know, sometimes we talk about a day without space. So if you think about everything you do from the time you get up in the morning to the time you go to bed and everything in between, space and the ability for us to leverage space impacts that.
Transportation, electric power grids, banking, and global communications. From watching television to predicting weather patterns to avoiding traffic on our daily commutes, satellites enable many real-time conveniences that have become integral to our daily lives.
High-energy lasers, frequency jamming, and missiles are all just a few ways that adversaries can disable our satellites, the effect of which would be crippling.
Both Russia and China have tested, and in the case of China, have deployed operationally anti-satellite weapons that can launch missiles from the ground right now to low Earth orbit and take out our or anyone else's satellites on orbit.
And if that's not concerning enough, there's this.
Russian nukes in space. Multiple sources are telling CNN tonight that the U.S. has new intelligence on Russia's efforts to deploy a nuclear anti-satellite system in space. This actually comes...
We have not talked about nuclear weapons in space. That's kind of a scary thought. Can you tell us about what's happening with the nuclear threat in space?
So it goes from those reversible effects, like jamming, to irreversible effects, like using kinetic-capable anti-satellite weapons. The far right of that, if you look at challenges to security in space, is could somebody pop a nuke in space?
The answer is yes. It already happened in 1962, and it wasn't the Soviet Union that did it. It was the United States.
The missile lifted off and began its long programmed trajectory.
Starfish Prime was the name of the high-altitude nuclear tests in space that the United States performed. The tests had surprising results.
Between the initial blast, the radiation from the initial blast, and the pumping of the belts in low Earth orbit over time took out about one-third of the satellites in orbit. Based on our Starfish Prime experience, you could take out a large swath of satellites.
If an adversary were to detonate a nuke in space, would that probably be their purpose?
I wouldn't understand any other purpose than to remove a large number of satellites at one time.
You'll hear more from John Huth later, but now it's blast off to Bennu.
10 seconds. 9, 8.
September 8th. 2016, the first U.S. mission to land on an asteroid.
One. And liftoff of OSIRIS-REx, its seven-year mission to boldly go to the asteroid Bennu and back.
Here again is the leader of the OSIRIS-REx team, Dr. Dante Loretta. Dante, can you give us some details about Bennu? Maybe start with its size and shape and tell us why it was the perfect asteroid for NASA and your team at the University of Arizona to study.
It's about 500 meters in dimension. That's about the height of the Empire State Building. Bennu is what we call an Apollo-type near-Earth asteroid, which means it has an orbit very similar to the Earth, and it actually crosses the orbit of the Earth and gets closer to the Sun than our planet does. We're interested in carbon and organic molecules. Bennu is one of the darkest asteroids in the solar system. It only reflects about 4% of the sunlight that hits its surface. And that dark material we inferred meant carbon rich, and therefore the scientific value of the asteroid was deemed worthy of being a target of a NASA mission.
Going to Bennu was in the works for more than a decade. Every detail was meticulously calculated. We can't say that about Dante's path to becoming the mission leader, though. His journey took on a more circuitous route. Dante Loretta grew up in Arizona. It was a location in the desert that he refers to as way off the grid. His family life wasn't great, and his escape came from exploring the world around him.
I started thinking about the adventure, the past, looking for treasures, kind of that adrenaline when you make a discovery. And it made me really think about those who had come before me. And I wondered, who was here before them? And how far back can you go till there has to be an origin? And what is that like? And how does that place us in the general context of this immense cosmos with all these other planets that are out there? Are we alone? Is this a common phenomena, or is it so incredibly rare? We're the only oasis of life in this entire universe.
After 4 years at the University of Arizona, he found himself at a crossroad in life, not knowing what path to take. So he did what felt right. He got in a van with some friends and he followed the dead. To be clear, we're talking about the Grateful Dead.
Yeah, when I was in my late teenage years, I discovered a band called The Grateful Dead. And I showed up at my first concert at the Shoreline Amphitheater in 1990. And this was the biggest party I had ever seen. Thousands of people just throwing down, anything went. It was a wild experience. And I kind of jumped in and enjoyed the time that I spent there.
So Dante, in the words of the great philosopher Jerry Garcia, once in a while you can get shown the light in the strangest of places if you look at it right. That's really the setup for me asking you to share the story of when you saw the light.
I had to pay my own way through college, and I was always working odd jobs. I was particularly good in the kitchen, did a lot of cooking, and in the summer of 1992, I got a job at a local dive bar in Tucson, Arizona called Mike's Place as the breakfast cook. Started at 5 a.m. on Saturday and Sunday mornings, and I usually cooked until about 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, just into the lunch shift. It was hard work and didn't pay a whole lot. I knew I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life, and I was just looking for that spark, for that inspiration. And I opened up the student newspaper, and there was a job ad that said, work for NASA. And man, that really got my mind going. That seemed so exciting. NASA was this beacon of hope. So it was this dream that maybe this was the path.
Believe it or not, that NASA gig was for creating a language to communicate with extraterrestrials should the situation present itself.
So the idea that there might be others out there and that we might make contact with them and then start exchanging information was beyond cool. I reveled in the job and I thought it was amazing.
A few years later, his NASA career really took off when a gift fell from the sky. It was something close to proof that life could exist beyond Earth. It wasn't extraterrestrials, but it was a fragment of an asteroid. We know it as a meteorite.
In 1996, a group of NASA scientists from the Johnson Space Center announced that they had found possible evidence for microbial fossilized life in a Martian meteorite that had landed in Antarctica. And this was stunning.
Good afternoon. I'm glad to be joined
and
by my
President Bill Clinton stood up and announced a major finding in meteorite research.
More than 4 billion years ago, This piece of rock was formed as a part of the original crust of Mars. After billions of years...
Wow, the president thinks meteorites are important.
It speaks of the possibility of life. It will surely be one of the most stunning insights into our universe that science has ever uncovered.
We're struggling to understand the origin of life and what needs to happen for that to occur and how rare of a phenomenon is it. If it happened both on Earth and on Mars, that means it's everywhere in the universe. That meteorite discovery really changed the game.
It was the strongest evidence yet that life could exist beyond Earth. So, in 1999, when Bennu was discovered, it was time to go get an uncontaminated piece of an asteroid. Dante Loretta went from a kid playing with rocks in the desert to a teen following a rock band to the principal investigator of the big rock that may contain molecular precursors to life. But that rock also represented a major natural and humanitarian disaster if it were to strike the Earth. So in 2013, when a totally different asteroid was going to be in the orbit of weather satellites, Dante was tapped to introduce the OSIRIS-REx mission to the public.
And this was really my first chance to go on TV with the title of NASA scientist under my name. And I thought that was just really cool.
The task seemed simple enough. Reassure the public that this asteroid wasn't going to hit the Earth. Everyone is safe, nothing to worry about. What could go wrong?
And then the questions start to change. And they're talking about, what are we going to do now that the asteroid has hit the Earth?
The eyes of the world today stunned by this image. This was debris from a meteor racing toward Earth, streaking across the sky there, crashing into the ground in those woods.
And then I keep hearing it over and over again, and I'm like, the asteroid hit the Earth.
It's the biggest meteor in more than a century to hit the planet. This one crashed in Russia. 1,000 people were injured from shards of flying glass and debris.
It's like, did we screw this up? Did we get this orbit so wrong that it actually came in on a collision course?
It came out of nowhere, a bright speck in the sky, soon streaking across the horizon, followed by an almost apocalyptic scene, a blinding flash of light, and then all hell broke loose.
It knocked down buildings, it injured thousands of people.
In the streets, pandemonium. Terrified residents thought the world was ending.
So I'm going on and on about safety and how excited I am, and there's this natural disaster playing out as the top story on the TV news.
This, of course, comes just as last night here we told you about the asteroid barreling toward Earth. That was something completely different, not to be confused with this meteor. Today, the asteroid.
It was just a huge cosmic coincidence. Our asteroid flew by the Earth as we predicted, no damage, but everybody forgot about that. So we dubbed it Asteroid Friday, February 15th, 2013.
Objects hurtling through space can be man-made, too. Here again is John Huth, DIA's Space and Counterspace Office Chief, with historian Paul Isaacson about a dangerous situation that doesn't get enough attention.
Let's talk about space junk. How much stuff is up there, and what is going on with that, and is that a big problem?
As of about 2 years ago, 25,000 pieces of trackable, either rockets, payloads, both active, inactive, and debris down to about 10 centimeters, about 4 inches on a side. And it is a problem and a growing problem.
Explorer, this is Houston.
Go ahead, Houston.
Mission abort. Repeat. Mission abort. Initiate.
Ever see the 2014 movie Gravity? It's a good movie with a powerful scene depicting what happens when countries blow up their own non-functioning satellites. George Clooney and Sandra Bullock are outside the Hubble telescope doing repairs when disaster comes right at them.
Debris from the missile strike has caused a chain reaction, hitting other satellites and creating new debris. Traveling faster than a high-speed bullet up towards your altitude.
Houston, update?
Well, we have a full-on chain reaction. It's been confirmed that it's the unintentional side effect of the Russians striking one of their own satellites.
When there is a collision, I mentioned 25,000. The other issue here is that 25,000 is trackable debris. There are 10 times more objects up there of what we call lethal non-trackable objects.
Explore new data coming through.
Think of something like a bullet that you don't know is coming. And those could be mission-ending or catastrophic in some cases.
And they're going at a speed of 30,000?
Low Earth orbit, think about 25,000 miles an hour, give or take.
Way faster than a bullet.
Way faster than a bullet.
Expect a communications blackout at any moment.
Half of North America just lost their Facebook.
Thankfully, the two-year trek to Bennu was a safe one. After arrival, OSIRIS-REx orbited the asteroid for another 2 years, creating a hazard map. This would be critical in determining the safest place to get a sample. And get this. Prior to sample collection, the spacecraft would be truly autonomous.
Control system has transitioned to touch and go mode.
Due to the 18-minute communications delay, Mission Control wasn't calling the shots. OSIRIS-REx alone would determine if and when to descend.
OREX is descending below 25 meters.
October 20th, 2020. Nail-biting time. Here's what it sounded like at Mission Control.
OREX has descended below the 5.
It's the moment of truth.
Hazard map is go for tag.
You can hear Dante.
We're going in. We're going in.
He's bursting. But remember, the mission wasn't simply to touch the asteroid. It was to scoop up pieces of it, too. But the density of the surface was still unknown. It was too risky for a conventional landing. The weight of the craft might cause it to sink or tip over.
There was so much uncertainty that we decided, let's just go in, make a brief contact, get the sample, and get out of there.
Attitude control system has transitioned to touch and go mode.
This maneuver was called touch and go, or tag.
We needed something that was really clean that could collect a sample in 5 short seconds. And we came up with this gas stimulation concept. I basically compare it to a leaf blower.
And we have touchdown!
For Dante Loretta, 16 years of work came down to this.
Sampling is in progress.
OSIRIS-REx unfurled its robotic arm to collect dust and samples.
Sample collection is complete. And the Bakalay burn has executed.
Congratulations. How are you guys feeling?
Transcendental. I mean, I can't believe we actually pulled this off.
This is special coverage of America's first asteroid sample return mission, OSIRIS-REx, as it arrives back to Earth after more than 7 years traveling in deep space. Joining me.
The trip home took just under 3 years. Plenty of time for the asteroid hunter to reflect on the achievement. Here's Dante Loretta reading a passage from his book.
An overwhelming sense of calm came over me as I settled into the feeling that everything we had worked for was finally coming to fruition. As the cool evening breeze caressed my face, my thoughts turned to the pledge I had made years ago, the bold promise that underpinned our entire proposal to NASA. A vow to unlock the mysteries of the origin of life itself. We had come so far, but there were still challenges ahead. And yet, as I looked out at the endless expanse of the universe, my resolve grew stronger. We were on the verge of something truly incredible, and I felt in my soul that the final phase of our mission, sample analysis, would reveal the deepest secrets of the cosmos.
NASA got a special delivery from space this morning. A capsule about the size of a car tire landed in the Utah desert, ending a 7-year, 4 billion mile round trip to collect the biggest haul of samples from an asteroid ever collected in space. The material will be...
You hadn't seen that capsule in 7 years. How'd you feel when you saw it again?
It was like seeing an old friend. I mean, it really was an emotional, like, reunion kind of moment. It was pretty charred and beat up from its fiery passage through the atmosphere, but man, was I happy to see that capsule.
OSIRIS-REx delivered twice the amount of material that NASA required, but did it deliver the ingredients of life on Earth?
The samples from Bennu are an absolute astrobiologist dream. Everything is pointing to these rocks forming in a very hydrated system, and I've even put out there maybe something like an ocean world, and then we get into the carbon. And this thing is loaded in organic molecules. It seems to be one of the most carbon-rich materials we've ever found from outer space. We're looking at amino acids, which are the building blocks of all proteins that life on Earth uses. So all of the components of biology as we know it seem to be coming from these carbon-rich asteroids. So the implications are really profound.
NASA is holding on to 70% of the rocks and the dust collected. The rest was distributed to more than 200 scientists around the world to study. Let the years of research begin. Dante, besides the carbon on Bennu, you also found water. Why is that important?
You can break the water into liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, which is an incredibly efficient rocket fuel. So you could turn Bennu and other asteroids like it basically into gas stations in outer space.
Gas stations in outer space?
Gas stations in outer space.
Lasers, satellites, space junk, spaceships, asteroids, and now gas stations in outer space? Wow. We couldn't help but think this was all sounding like something right out of the Jetsons. And we were right.
Lucky I landed near this self-service fuel station.
May I help you, sir?
Give me $2 worth of high-octane pellets and check the radium, will you?
Remember the Jetsons? The space-age TV cartoon family that lived in 2062. Well, way back in 1962, the Jetsons introduced America to cutting-edge technology that's now a part of our everyday lives on Earth and in space. Except for the flying car.
Well, here we go again. Another night, another traffic jam. Boy, the spaceway traffic gets worse every night.
We're still waiting for the flying car.
Looks like an opening up ahead. Space hog! Sunday astronaut!
We began this podcast discussing nefarious aspects of technology in space, but that's not how we wanted to end it. So we thought a visit with the Jetsons, the show that introduced us to moving sidewalks, smart watches, and robots who follow voice commands, seemed like a good idea. After all, if it wasn't for them, maybe we wouldn't even have self-driving cars, or so many ways of keeping eyes and ears on our adversaries. So we spoke with someone with high orbit knowledge about the show that became a blueprint for the future.
Hello, my name is Danny Graydon, and I am a subject matter expert on The Jetsons.
Well, I guess there's a SME for everything. Danny's a senior lecturer at the University of Hertfordshire in the United Kingdom. He specializes in film and comics, and he wrote a book called The Jetsons, The Official Guide to the Cartoon Classic. Thanks for joining us, Danny, to talk about this little sci-fi show that had such a profound impact.
My absolute pleasure.
Before we get into the push-button gizmos and the gadgets that now permeate our everyday lives, how about some background on this iconic pop culture classic?
When The Jetsons first came out in late 1962, it was a very interesting time in America. You were getting the beginnings of a more, shall we say, utopian outlook and what that might possibly be like. So even though this is a children's cartoon and did sort of postulate a very flamboyant future, it was very, very compelling.
Earlier in this episode, we talked about the current space race in terms of global competition and ensuring space superiority. Tell us about the original space race and how it influenced the show.
With the space race, there was a sense of, you know, whoever wins that race defines the future.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
It was fascinating to me because it was a show that clearly had an iconic impact, but also where it fit into American history in the early 1960s, and the way that it was looking at the future in a very positive and optimistic way.
A few days after Kennedy's Moon Proclamation in 1962, The Jetsons debuted on Sunday nights on ABC. It was the network's first program ever broadcast in color, and it was unsuccessful. Due to poor ratings, the Hanna-Barbera space-age counterpart to the Stone Age Flintstones survived only one season. Just 24 episodes. That's it. Only after it moved to Saturday mornings did the family from Orbit City finally find its audience, and they were elevated to another stratosphere in cartoon lore.
It's quite interesting because it speaks to a time in television history where shows that didn't have a huge footprint, as it were, could actually have quite a seismic impact in capturing an audience's imagination.
Let's talk about a few of those innovations that captured the audience's imagination and their modern-day counterparts. They had a device called the televiewer. We know it today as the internet.
Well, the televiewer is basically like a large flat-screen TV, a source of all their entertainment and indeed communication.
And now you'd better hurry too, George. You'll be late for work.
I know. I'll just skip through the headlines. President to ask for more taxes. So what else is news? Well now, football coach predicts victory at tonight's game. I wonder what he's got to say.
We'll murder them.
George, you're late.
And what was the visiphone?
So the visiphone is a way of being able to see the person that you're talking to.
I'll speak to my mother. Mother, I was just going to call you.
You were? Well, what did George?
Well, they nailed that one. Certainly looks like FaceTime and Zoom. I love the name of this next one, the Peekaboo Prober.
Have you ever taken one of our Peekaboo Prober capsules?
Peekaboo Prober capsules? Nope. How's it work?
So the Peekaboo Prober is a pill that is swallowed by George Jetson, and it can obviously give images of his insides to help with medical issues and things like that.
You're going to televise pictures of my insides?
That's right.
Being in the intelligence gathering business, I think the invention that would be DIA's favorite is called the Electric Snoop. Tell us about the Electric Snoop.
The electric snoop, a device that can fly and provide images from what it sees, is very obviously a precursor to what we see today in drones.
We're late again, aren't we?
We are?
We are. Take a look. Is that you or isn't it?
I don't photograph too well, do I, sir?
You don't work very well either.
So do you think that some of that far-out technology that we saw on the Jetsons actually inspired future inventors?
The ideas that were being thought about in the early 1960s, even for comedic value, those ideas, even in their broadest form, can inspire people who get involved in science and technology and provide them with the impetus to create something approximating that with contemporary technology.
The Jetsons looked 100 years into the future and had remarkable accuracy. So we figured that John Huth, DIA's chief of space and counterspace office, should be able to do it pretty well, too. Here's his chance with historian Paul Isaacson.
So the Jetsons was on in 1962, or started in 1962, and they were projecting 100 years in the future. Where do you see us on that continuum that they dreamed up?
Certainly we will have been back on the moon for hopefully several decades, maybe setting up similar things to what we're talking about on the moon on Mars and starting to look out maybe in the distant reaches of the solar system and hopefully with advances in propulsion and life support systems and our ability maybe to live in the environment, we will be much further along.
Still no flying cars, huh? Oh, well. Be sure to check back with us in 100 years, in 2124, to verify the accuracy of John Huth's prognostications. That's if an asteroid doesn't get us first. As always, thanks for listening to DIA Connections.